Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, welcome to the group chat. The long dark of January is now behind us. Richard, Zara and Gavin all here to discuss the latest news. February, is it spring or would you start?
Oh, we already
Well, there's 1 hour of January left if you're watching this on TV, actually. We're into the final hour of January.
I think you can say it's good.
It's finally gone. Yeah.
But are you a spring, February?
Love a spring.
But do you think February is spring?
Is February spring?
Oh.
Because meteorologically, no. But in the Celtic calendar, it's very cold in school.
I think spring is sort of like that after Paddy's Day space.
Which is the astronomical one because it's all measured by light. But if February is spring, then doesn't autumn have to be August? And that doesn't seem right.
It's not right.
Yeah.
It's just, but that's the way it was taught in primary school,
wasn't it? That's it. It's the primary curriculum. Or how do you tell someone that autumn, which is on four, doesn't end with Gera 4, which is October?
There you go. The kids have been taught wrong.
Pressing questions of the week.
Anyway, though.
Norma Foley soon, I'm sure.
Spring has sprung. Instalment. Rebirth. New life. After 2 years away, finally, the Northern Irish Assembly and Executive is coming back. Symmetrically, it'll be back on Saturday, 2 years to the day since it was suspended. Now, it comes at a very interesting time, and this is why we wanted to start the podcast with this, is that Sinn Féin, for the very first time, is going to have the most senior political office in the North. Michelle O'Neill will be the first Republican or Nationalist minister to hold the first minister's office in the North. So that is very historic. But Sinn Féin, at the same time, we've been about 2 years, I think, now of seeing an inevitability about Sinn Féin leading the next government in the Republic.
Mm.
And now that's starting, that long march to power seems to stutter somewhat. So, Sarah, first off, we're going to look at sort of the issues around Sinn Féin and whether or not, you know, them having their, one of their probably the brightest hours in the North is actually coming at a time when they're receding a little bit in the Republic.
Yeah.
But the history of the moment is still quite significant.
It's quite significant. And even I was watching an interview that Mary Lou MacDonald gave to Channel 4 News actually last night. And she was talking about that and looking at how, you know, in best case scenario, I think Gary Givens was asking her, you know, like, eventually, if you became the Taoiseach, you then have two women at the top of Sinn Féin sort of running Ireland as a country. And she had this big, massive smile on her face. And she sort of was, you know, I don't think Mary Lou MacDonald has accepted that there's any sort of risk of that not happening at the moment. I think she's very much streaming forward.
Gavin, eyes on the prize.
With eyes on the prize. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it is worth saying, and not to immediately piddle in their chips, but like the office of First Minister is literally like completely tied at the hip to the office of Deputy First Minister. So although there is obviously a symbolism to it, Northern Ireland was created so that the unionists would be almost permanently a majority. So the idea that the largest party is a nationalist one would aspire to get rid of Northern Ireland long term, that obviously does have a symbolism. But in practical terms, Deputy First Minister is a joint office. Mm-hmm. In fact, when Michelle O'Neill had that job, they used to call it Joint First Minister to try and downgrade the fact that it appeared to some people to be secondary when actually it's not.
The way I got around this yesterday, just to try and sort of unmuddy it, is to say that it's the First Minister's office is like the most senior job title. I think it is, rather than most senior position, because they're both equal in terms of actual power and esteem.
That's a nice
But it was the most senior job title, as
But there is like a serious symmetry to that. People long term, like my dad sent me a message when the election happened for Stormont like nearly 2 years ago, like from Terence O'Neill to Michelle O'Neill, because the last time that Northern Ireland had an independent prime minister of its own before the Troubles and everything had to be shut down, it was a Tory called Terence O'Neill. And now it's going to have Michelle O'Neill, who is from a Tyrone Sinn Féin Republican family.
Well, you were there yesterday, Richard. What was the atmosphere like? Take us behind the scenes. Give us a sense of what it's like to be there on the day.
It was grand. Like, there wasn't a huge amount happening. There was a couple of press conferences. I think everybody saw Michelle O'Neill, Conor Murphy and Mary Lou MacDonald doing their press conference in the hall in Stormont, which is one of my favourite places to report. Stormont is great. Like, if our parliament, if the Dáil had such a nice backdrop... Oh, we'd be doing well. Like the drive, you drive up, it's a big, obviously it's called the hill. So you go up the hill, you're there, it's magnificent parliament buildings. You see all of Belfast around you. It was a very visible day. Everybody saw the blue skies there yesterday. It was absolutely gorgeous. Often very cold up there because it is very elevated.
Because it basically has a microclimate because of how tall it is. So even if it's warm and the rest of Belfast on a good day, it can still be like pretty freezing up there. Not so much yesterday.
No, it was nice. It was actually not too bad. It turned to 2 or 3 degrees.
He had the big coat on, I saw you. He had the big coat on.
No, that would be my lighter of the two coats. My Virgin Media jacket is my bigger coat.
Oh, is it? All right.
The branded jacket is the one I get out on the cold days.
Okay.
Sometimes I might stick the two jackets on.
I can't bring myself to wear the branded jacket, by the way.
I haven't been given my branded jacket yet.
Not. Okay.
I would recommend it. It's cozy anyway. Okay. But anyway, the atmosphere was quite good because I wouldn't regularly get up to do Northern Irish politics, yeah. But when you do, it's always nice because there's a great crew of other journalists up there. Yeah. Even the political staffers up there are all very nice.
Yes, it was a big day to be there as well. It's one of those great days to be there.
I suppose I don't think so, because I think they were all very much in the pattern of this hasn't been fully agreed yet.
Okay, mm-hmm.
They weren't fully celebrating anything yet. Yeah. That'll probably happen this weekend. But Stormont, recommend a visit if you're ever up in Belfast or in Belfast. It's just a smashing place. I was in the coffee shop / gift shop for a scone and a warm mug of tea.
Did you pronounce scone?
Would there be a problem with pronouncing?
Would there not be a sconism? Would that not be one of those cross-community things?
Yeah. I don't know. They were selling wine. Northern Ireland Assembly wines there. Sauvignon Blancs and whatnot. I'd say they've been sitting on the shelf a long time. Corked.
Made in Chile, I saw.
Yeah.
I imagine we must bring in some Oroctus wine for like our next little summer finish up. Just to give.
They
you
do have that. Taste.
There is an Oroctus wine, yeah.
Anyway, what else do they sell in the gift shop, by the way?
Rulers.
Can I ask you, who's using rulers anymore apart from primary school students?
I think that's probably it.
I'd imagine they're the full...
Maths teachers for primary school children.
Great.
Pencils. There was a couple of like... bits and bobs, keyrings.
Maybe the civil servants who've been running the budget, who've been dealing with all
this,
the public sector workers who've been saying, oh, you want this percentage? Ruler. No, can't have that. Because that's actually where the rubber meets the road here, isn't it? That Northern Ireland has basically been like idling, like it's a car parked with the engine barely running for the last 2 years. No one's been able to do anything.
This is what I actually wanted to talk about, because it's so easy just to get bogged down when you're talking about Northern Irish politics into an us and them situation, or the absence of leadership, or the fact that it's been suspended for so long. It's like, oh, why aren't these politicians doing their job? But the real life impact of this has been quite severe, Gavin. You talk about public services there, whether it's hospitals, schools, roads, support for parental carers, kids with special needs. All of this has just fallen off entirely as a result of there not being any politicians at the lever.
Yeah, the starting salary for a teacher in Britain is £30,000. The starting salary for somebody in Northern Ireland is £24,000. In real terms, the value of the wage of somebody in the public sector in Northern Ireland has fallen by about 11% in the last couple of years, because they haven't had a pay freeze, but there's been no one around to sanction a pay hike. And in the meantime, of course, there's been a cost of living crisis, and where their counterparts in Britain have had governments that are prepared to top up their pay to make them deal with it, there hasn't been the similar in the north as well. And there's a whole ream of other things, people who might be thinking about Euro 2028 and the redevelopment of Casement Park. All of that kind of depends on some minister eventually somewhere saying, right, here is spending that we're going to sanction, or here is planning permission that we're going to approve. And none of that's been happening. So aside from the bigger... Northern Ireland being a chessboard for Irish nationalism versus British unionism, like there's practical measurable things on the ground. There's due to be another strike again on Thursday this week, so the day after we air this on television. The last one a couple of weeks ago, there were 170,000 participants in that strike. That's 10% of the entire population of Northern Ireland. That would be the equivalent of 520,000 people
walking off
the streets in Dublin, Cork and Galway and Limerick and Waterford. Like the scale of that is enormous. And if something like that wasn't going to like calcify in people's minds the need for there to be something, like that, of course, that's going to be the trigger.
But it's like that point you make about even like losing 2 years in terms of like capital projects, big investment things, things that will move the region forward, things that are big developments. That's 2 years is a long time to lose in all of that.
Particularly when, like, before those 2 years, there was a brief period where they were around again for, I think, probably another 2 years during COVID. But they were gone for 3 years before that.
January, so basically, February 22. And then before that, 3 years where they had nothing.
Yeah.
So the last 7 years, they've been shut down or there's been a pandemic.
Yeah. So, I mean, just the real hardship of it, because the North has been economically deprived in many areas. It has been the most economically deprived area in Western Europe in many ways. Mental health issues, all that sort of stuff. So I actually think that there is an opportunity here for Sinn Féin in terms of having their hand on the lever, as it were, even symbolically in the North, if they go some way towards pushing cash out. And they have a lot more cash to spend as a result of this deal, which has been done by the British government. That could go some way towards, softening their position on how they are viewed by softer unionists, I suppose, in some ways. But it's actually in the Republic where the most interesting thing happening with Sinn Féin is at the moment. In that, we've had an opinion poll last weekend, the Red Sea Business Post poll, which showed a 4% drop in support for Sinn Féin, 25% down from 29%. This is down 11 points as well in 2 years. That is quite the drop, Sarah.
It is quite the drop. And actually, particularly, I suppose, when we look at what has really worked for Sinn Féin in terms of their success in recent years, has been sort of always coming across as being the party that has their finger on the pulse of what matters to people and being very, you know, Sinn Féin has always been the kind of party that's always been able to push forward real life examples of people that have been affected by policies that they feel, you know, weren't handled properly by government. And that's been probably the backbone in a lot of ways, I would say, to their success in the last couple of years. And certainly in recent times, they don't seem to be hitting the marker.
Where have they gone wrong, Gav?
If you do a deep dive into the polling figures, you can almost reach the conclusion that they're being outflanked at either end of the spectrum. So if you look at the short-term poll of the weekend, 25% nationwide, down, as you say, 4 points from the previous one. Now, there's always a danger, by the way, before we get into this, of making too much of one poll. But when you go and break down the individual demographics and you see that it's distributed across regions, they're losing support everywhere geographically, they're losing support among multiple age groups, multiple income groups, there is a consistency to it. But it's not, before people think it is, it's not because they've decided to go to Washington for St. Patrick's Day. They're being somewhat outflanked by the SDLP on that note, but they decided to take up the invite. Now that the party holds the job of First Minister, it's kind of implausible that you would go to Washington and not take up the invite. So being outflanked on that front, but the poll was barely overlapped with them deciding that, and it barely overlapped with the referendums. Short term, they've lost 6 points in Connacht and Ulster and 5 points in Munster. Now, the Connacht and Ulster one is difficult to break down because if you look at who's gaining at their expense, there's no obvious standout party or group that's kind of gaining that. But in Munster, they've dropped 5 points. And independents are up by 3 of those 5. Now, you could just take a fairly rational leap of faith and say, well, the likes of Ross Grey or a lot of other demonstrations that there have been in Munster where people don't feel like their area is capable of dealing with a higher level of international protection applicants. It doesn't take a huge amount of extra faith to presume that that's kind of what's ultimately behind it. And very quickly, long term, you mentioned 36%, which is what they were in the middle of 2022. If you go and do a breakdown then, back then, they were going to gain almost half, almost literally half, 47% of every voter between 35 and 54. Now that's fallen to 29%. And that's before the knock-on consequence of deciding that you want to devalue all houses. So when they talk about having the average house in Dublin being worth €300,000, what does that make the average house in Galway or Waterford or Cork worth or Tipperary? If you want to devalue everyone's primary asset, that's going to bite people sooner rather than later too.
And last time out in 2020, my writing saying the issue was that they didn't run enough people nearly, that after the fact, Mary MacDonald sort of regretted that there weren't more people on the ticket.
Take your native Waterford, five-seat constituency, 20% would be a quota. David Cullinan got 39% of the vote. If David Cullinan were on the ballot twice, he'd have been elected twice. Mary MacDonald left a seat behind in Dublin Central. You do that all over the country and suddenly you've left a dozen seats behind and then you could lead the government. They presumed that they would just be able to pick up those seats again next time and they'd be back in the driving seat. If you're only getting 25% and your closest challengers are at 20, it's not as much of a given as that.
In the Red Sea poll, Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil and the Greens now at a combined 41%. So Zara, we've been feeling like for a long time there's been an air of inevitability, even if you speak to people in those parties, that they wouldn't be in the next government. This isn't a done deal anymore.
It's not, but like I suppose I hate to say it and it's a cliche, but a week is a long time in politics and you've seen yourself how things can swing and change. Like we're a long way off yet.
Miles off.
You know, we are miles off. I think sometimes you can kind of overtalk these situations and, you know, and like in some ways as well, I suppose, you know, for the last couple of years, people have just made this assumption that, you know, Marilyn MacDonald would be the next Taoiseach and it was a foregone conclusion. And actually, you know, I would say the closer you get to an election, maybe the more sort of picky the voter becomes as well and the more selective they become. And they've become a bit more, I think voters in recent times have definitely become a lot more, you know, there was a time, I suppose, where like there was generations of parents and grandparents who were loyal to certain parties and that there was brand loyalty. And, you know, this house votes Fianna Fáil, that house votes Fine Gael. And you could nearly, the local representative who was running while they were canvassing could nearly have on their notes clock which house voted which way. Yeah. Whereas we have totally changed the society now and probably for the best in a sense that voters now realise that they have choice and they understand that whatever they tick on the ballot paper can have consequences for how things play out for them in the future. So I actually think there's a lot to play for this time out.
Yeah, as you say, Gavin, they've been outflanked on the left in terms of on Gaza by the Social Democrats. They've been outflanked on Washington by the SDLP. But then immigration seems to be something which is a sticking point for them. A lot of their supporters would probably be of the view that they want More stricter controls on immigration. That's what the polling data would appear to show us as well. Also, I think there is an issue there. I mean, I remember in November 23rd, on the day of the Dublin riots, after the stabbing on Parnell Square, there was a lot of people, a lot of the far-right agitators were calling out Mary Lou McDonald by name. They see her as part of the problem in terms of being part of this conspiracy and blah, 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 grand replacement theory. But in terms of actually addressing the immigration issue, you have seen a step change from how the government is going to approach this. Now, the word crackdown and clampdown has been used in the press to describe this. The government publicly not using those words and kind of stepping back from it. I think privately, they're probably not all that displeased with those words being used.
It's probably difficult to really dispute with the ultimate meaning of what they've done as being something of a crackdown, or at least a hardening of positions. They're adding Algeria and Botswana to what's called their safe list. And that effectively means those countries are presumed to be safe. If you're coming from there, you are presumed by default not to be fleeing any kind of hardship or persecution. And they're more likely to take a dismal view of your application. They might still entertain it, of course. They'll give you the full regards, but they won't include it there. Helen McIntyre, he said something very interesting at a press conference about this on Tuesday, that when they added the last batch of countries to this safe list, they saw applications from those countries plummet. That effectively, that they were almost then saying, without saying it out loud, that many of the people applying from those countries, the likes of Georgia, were coming for economic reasons and not because they were trying to flee from some sort of hardship and claiming asylum, as it's literally thought of. So the implication then has to be, well, we're going to see fewer applications from these countries. And they might say, well, that's just us trying to keep the system more streamlined. But it's hard not to think of that as being some way of lowering the number of people that they have to house, and therefore the implications that they'll have on communities around the country that end up housing them.
And what was his point yesterday about chartering flights?
They are looking at, they're not committed to yet, but they put out a tender where they're basically asking airlines to see, would you be interested in keeping a fleet aside so that on the occasion where we need to send people back, that we'll do it. They're not committed to it yet, and practically speaking, it's hard to imagine exactly when you'd end up doing it. Do you have a full plane's worth of people to send back to? Nigeria is one country with a lot of applicants. So when they would actually happen, I don't know. But again, the fact that they're signalling they might think about it looks to all the world as if they're hardening their position.
Well, in terms of Gaza, the United Nations Relief Works Agency, I should say, for Palestinian refugees is an agency we've talked about on the podcast before in terms of it's the biggest agency providing aid and support to Palestinians in Gaza. And now it's facing a huge crisis, which really threatens its own existence. Sarah, what's the background on this?
Yeah, so in recent days, people have heard that there were allegations made against 12 UNRWA workers, allegations made by Israel that those workers had been involved in the October 7th terrorist attacks in the kibbutz in Israel. So from the outset, I think it's important to say that, you know, UNRWA has around 13,000 employees working in Gaza. This involves 12 people, nine of which have been left go. This information does come from Israeli intelligence. I suppose a lot of people might question the timing of the release of that information. It did come a day after the ICJ interim ruling. But it is a very serious situation because a number of countries now have stopped providing funding to UNRWA, which means in reality, and, you know, I heard someone speaking earlier in the week saying that, like, UNRWA is the type of organisation, it kind of works hand to mouth. It doesn't have sort of a backflow of cash. So, you know, in the next, you know, 4 weeks, conceivably, you know, month to month, they will essentially start to run out of money. And the real people who will be affected by that are Palestinians in Gaza.
Well, that is the thing. It is the pulling of funding and the immediate pulling of funding by the likes of the United States, the United Kingdom, Germany, Australia, all of its major backers. So I think more than half of the committed funding you'd get for UNRWA come from these countries which have already pulled their weight from behind it. Now, Ireland and Norway are amongst the countries who have said, we're going to continue to fund UNRWA. Because, Gavin, many people who are alive now and are still surviving in Gaza, despite months of, you know, the assault and onslaught that is happening in Gaza, they're alive purely because of UNRWA.
Yeah, pretty much. Like, UNRWA was probably not a thing that was on many people's radars before October the 7th and what's happened since, but it might just be worth a little crash course in where it came from. UNRWA is basically performs all the functions of a government that Palestine is not capable of doing. So not the, like, picking a president or a prime minister of all of that, but the people who run your schools, the people who run basic public services, certain amount of sanitation, certain amount of healthcare, all the things that ordinarily a government would do, UNRWA does. UNRWA was set up by the UN in the late 1940s because after Israel was created, again, by UN decision, they recognised that this was going to displace millions of Palestinians to nearby countries, predominantly Syria, Jordan and Egypt, but a few others that were scattered around the Middle East as well. And UNRWA was set up to provide basically all the services that a government would do to those displaced people. So if you're a Palestinian person who's been living in Jordan for the last 7 decades because you were effectively displaced from your natural home by the creation of Israel, UNRWA runs your hospitals. UNRWA teaches your kids. Mm-hmm. UNRWA provides local policing. UNRWA does all of those things. The Irish embassy, it's not an embassy because we don't officially recognise it as a state, but the Irish mission in Ramallah is the mission to the occupied Palestinian territories and UNRWA, because we basically recognise it as effectively a government in exile. But the key thing about UNRWA is that it is not funded out of the UN's direct budget. It's entirely through voluntary contributions from mm-hmm. other countries. Ireland has upped its contribution to about 18 million. Ordinarily, it will be 8. But because it's all voluntary, if the UN or the US, or as might happen now, the EU collectively decide to defund it, then all those Palestinians, both in Gaza and across the Middle East, that were dependent on UNRWA, have nothing. Mm. I mean, they literally have nothing.
It is another form of attack, I suppose, on people on, you know, in desperate situations, Richard, to pull those resources from them. It's a, like, it's somewhat of a bizarre decision on the part of the likes of, you say, the UK and the US. Look, you could acknowledge as well, and it's important to say, that the allegations made against the individuals here, you know, include things like, you know, ranging from involvement in kidnapping hostages to being told to set up an operations room. They're very serious allegations. But, like, the answer isn't to pull resources from people who have nothing as it is.
Yeah, it is staggering how quickly some of the countries arrived at the decision that this was going to be their solution. We're just going to stop that pipeline of money to help people. And it is the most direct way, as we say, of helping people, civilians who are in harm's way in Gaza. Now, as you say, very, very serious allegations here, including basically involvement in the attacks themselves. Mm-hmm. But I noted, when I was looking at the statements released by each of the governments in terms of why they'd decided to pull funding or pause funding, and places like Australia, we would have quite a liberal government who are like, well, look, we support UNRWA, we support the work that they do, but this is only a temporary thing. But at a time when, you know, lives are being lost at a shocking and sickening scale.
Yeah.
Like the rate of civilian casualties and deaths in Gaza is greater than anything we have seen since the Second World War in terms of civilian population. That is more than half of the buildings, according to the BBC, in Gaza have been razed to the ground at this point in time. Mm. It's becoming uninhabitable. And the only places, and the places which are using, as you say, are running the most shelters, schools and hospitals, are effectively UNRWA. So the pulling of this is very, very quick from Western governments, who have been very slow in other ways to address some of the key concerns of this conflict.
Here's an important point as well, though, that needs to sort of be just aired out, is that, like, it's very difficult for the likes of the US and even, you know, even journalists trying to corroborate what's coming out in this Israeli intelligence. It's very difficult to go back and sort of fact check some of the information as well. And, you know, not that, you know, these are allegations. It's very difficult to independently verify those allegations. I think that's a really important point. Also, I think there does have to be questions asked about, as I mentioned earlier, the timing of the release of that information, Gavin. Like, you know, especially when you consider that, you know, Benjamin Netanyahu essentially dismissed the ICJ, you know, outcome of the day and said, well, that's grand, you know, we're not committing genocide, so, you know, on we go, sort of thing. And that was definitely the attitude. And then the next day, oh, by the way, these aid workers have done terrible things. You know, these are serious allegations, but it's very difficult to actually verify them independently.
And when you put that alongside the statements of other Israeli politicians, government and opposition in the more recent past, some of the hardliners who take the view that basically there is no way to peacefully coexist alongside Gaza and that the population must be gotten rid of, it's the only way to eliminate Hamas, and then Israel should claim that for itself. They've said that as a precursor to that, you can't do that for as long as UNRWA is around. Because if you have a UN agency that's effectively there sanctioning these people's existence and providing them with services, then you're not going to move them. Mm-hmm. So they've literally said that the abolition or the disbandment of UNRWA is a precursor to having Gaza effectively cleansed. Mm-hmm. So when you put that alongside the curious timing, and look, you have to take the accusations at face value, and
Absolutely.
They're pretty significant.
Yeah.
You know, 12 UN staff being involved in a major act of terrorism, it's not acceptable, and it has to be given its due diligence and investigated. But when you put the two together, cynicism naturally follows, and it's understandable in a case like this.
Well, if they knew before now, you know, if they knew before now, October 7th is a long time ago. Okay, I accept that it takes time to gather information. But if they knew before now, why not say it before now?
And the UN's major judicial organ says on Friday that we need you to take interim measures. And then you come out on Saturday or Sunday and say, by the way, the UN has also been funding local terrorism. Mm. It's, you know, you'd raise eyebrows.
Yeah, I saw this morning, actually, Al Jazeera reported, it quoted another report by the Times of Israel, saying that privately there's a fear amongst some Israeli officials about the humanitarian catastrophe that would ensue in the result of a complete defunding of UNRWA, which I actually should say, if you look on the State of Israel's Instagram page, they're pushing the hashtag defund UNRWA. And they are, again, pointing to 12 of their employees' involvement in the October 7th attack, blah, 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 blah. But the idea that the State of Israel is publicly saying defund UNRWA, while privately some of their officials are saying, well, look, this is probably a big problem for us if we had a major humanitarian catastrophe worsened by the lack of available resources for UNRWA, that would then reflect poorly once again on the State of Israel in the international sense. But again, I can just tell you, over the last few minutes, there's been a private meeting where Antonio Guterres, the UN Secretary General, is pleading with the countries who have pulled their funding to put it back online. The WHO's chief, Dr. Tedros, a man we were familiar with during the pandemic, says, look, this is going to make the worst situation imaginable even worse somehow as a result of all this. So I guess we're going to have to wait and see how that all plays out. It is interesting, as you say, Zara, that it comes after the ICJ as part of their interim measures said you need to get a lot more humanitarian aid into Gaza. And the best conduit for that has now been affected the day after as a result of this disclosure by Israel. Now, in terms of something else in the Middle East, which caught your eye, Gavin, a drone attack on US troops. Now, for the longest time, we've been talking about the worst thing that could possibly happen is this war spilling over. And this is one of the most violent instances of which it appears to be linked to everything that we've seen. Why is this so significant?
It's the first instance in which American troops or people serving in uniform for the United States as part of their armed forces have died since the events of October 7th. Naturally enough, there are American armed forces dotted around different countries all across the Middle East, both in Israel and among some of the Arab countries. But this is the first time that any of those have died in any of the skirmishes that have followed October the 7th. And that then begs a question for Joe Biden. Well, what are you going to do? Because anything that results in the loss of American life naturally is going to prompt some kind of reaction. But if we're talking about avoiding a full-on conflict, well, the awkward thing here is that much like Hezbollah in Lebanon, much like Hamas in Gaza, the people who are notionally responsible for this attack in Jordan are effectively militants that are ultimately bankrolled and backed by the government of Iran. Mm. So if you take them on, then are you basically also poking a bear and picking a fight with Hamas and Hezbollah and ultimately the Iranian government? Mm. Because if you have America basically picking fight with the Iranian government, that's the reason why earlier this week, don't want to be motivated to put too much stock in it, but World War III was the top trending topic on X. Mm. And it's the sort of thing, these big conflicts spill out because small conflicts and then people have allies and then the whole thing just kind of kicks off like a pub brawl. It's the sort of thing that happens. And what was really interesting is Joe Biden says he knows what he's going to do in response, but at the time of recording, it hasn't been done yet. None of the rest of us know exactly what he's got in his mind.
Mm. It does appear from some reporting in the US that he's not going to launch a direct attack on Iran anyway. Well, let's hope he doesn't, because that would probably
be it.
There's
people who want him to.
Yeah, there are
American
yeah.
politicians that were openly calling for it.
Mm. Which is why, that is something which is, you know, it's difficult to get your head around, that you do have very openly and very often you have hawks calling for full on, let's poke. You know, a major regional power, and let's see what happens
absolutely
as a result of this.
Demented concept.
Yeah. I guess we'll have to wait and see. I mean, he says that he doesn't, like, he has, in fairness, tried to calm things down by saying, look, we don't want a wider regional war here. Mm. It could be, again, more strikes against militant groups as Pakistan and Iran exchanged missile fire. There's so many countries who've been, you know, enveloped in this at this point in time. It is staggering. Zara, you've kept your ear to the ground, actually, in terms of, we mentioned the ICJ case. Now, pressure has been put on the Irish government in terms of how it's going to respond to it. Are we any clearer as to what Ireland is actually going to do about it?
I would say that at the moment, what it looks like is it's going to be at least probably 6 months before we really know whether or not Ireland will get behind it. You know, it's definitely, there's a lot of more paperwork that needs to be handed over to the court. It could take about 6 months for South Africa to put through its full case and its full position. And I think it won't be until then whether Ireland will decide whether or not to back and get on board with the case. So a little bit more clarity. I think it just, the clarity being that we're not going to get an answer anytime soon. I think it's going to be about 6 months.
Yeah, was it last week's episode or the week before? They're kind of all running together now, but we had a discussion around what exactly is the procedure and some of the information campaign that the government was waging to try and underline to people that it's not about taking sides in these cases. What has effectively kind of come out as the result of all of that is that if we need South Africa to file the full kind of formal case, I think it's called the memoriam, is what they call it in court parlance, that could be 6 months away. And only after you've seen South Africa's case, do you know what stance you're going to take? Do you support the same interpretation of law? Do you understand the words to mean the same thing that they do? And only after that do you actually file something, which means that, you know, all the dull motions last week, there's more again this Wednesday night. By the time people get to see or hear this, they'll have happened again. But they're all asking Ireland to intervene. Just the process, the procedure just isn't there for months at least. And this is going to be running on for a while.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Now, for almost a full day last week, AI-generated, deepfake, non-consensual, pornographic images of Taylor Swift rapidly spread online, particularly on the website formerly known as Twitter. One image in particular racking up 47 million views before it was taken down by X.
47.
Now, it was largely taken down because Taylor Swift's fans mobilized, but this is a huge, huge ramifications, this idea of AI-generated pornographic images without the subject's consent or knowledge or approval. The White House even actually acted on this, calling it alarming. Twitter, or X, eventually, of course, then removed it and then blocked searches of Taylor Swift's name, which is quite a substantial step. Now, I see that they've lifted that, but this is a massive, massive, you know, can of worms that has been opened at this point in time, Zara. Yeah, it's deeply distressing, I'm sure, as well.
Deeply distressing. And I think, you know, let's be honest, image-based sexual violence is nothing new. But when you have somebody like Taylor Swift, who's such a big icon, you know, and it happens directly to Taylor Swift, it does bring it into sharp focus. As you say, Richard, it's the type of thing that, you know, like, X is notorious for not taking things down and not taking dealing with things, you know, in an efficient and sort of, you know, suitable way in many cases. Yet we do see them now moving to take down these pictures of Taylor Swift. And it's interesting that it's taken it happening to Taylor Swift for it to make a change. But here, as long as it makes a difference, I suppose, who will question that? I just think that the reality of this, and I've seen a lot of other women talk about this, women who aren't as famous as Taylor Swift, women who might have maybe small followings on Instagram or TikTok or whatever, who've also found themselves in a situation, like the impact it had on their lives, women talking about going for a job and having a folder presented to them with these pictures and sort of going, you know, we did a Google search on you before you came in for the job interview and actually here's all these pictures we found of you. Can you explain, please, you know, where did this come from? And sort of like finding out in that setting that these pictures have been generated about you is, wow. I find that horrific. I can't even believe that we live in a world where that's actually possible now.
Mm. Yeah, I'm obviously, you'd never kind of endorse it happening, but in a way you try and have to find some cause for optimism out of all of this, which is that at least it does show that X, when the circumstances are right, does...
It's insane to be saying, well done X for this.
I don't mean
47 million views before they decided to act on it, and now people are still pushing it.
And they only act to cause it's Taylor Swift.
Well, my point is that does it now create a precedent where at least it's acknowledged that they do these things?
No, it absolutely won't create a precedent. They're not going to do this for everybody because they haven't done it for anybody, as Zara has already said.
Yeah.
There's people who have had this happen to them multiple times at this point in time, and they won't be as lucky as Taylor Swift was, even though she's the victim of this. They have tried for ages to try and get AI deepfake images of themselves in pornographic settings pushed online, and they haven't been able to get them removed. And do you trust X or Twitter or Elon Musk to try and, you know, make a big change to his policy about these? No, because
the people
who are pushing these things and the people who are actually caused this to happen are people who are already paying for blue ticks.
But then why did they do it this time?
Because of Taylor Swift, there was such a huge
Taylor Swift,
thing.
Who is now like notably already not using the platform herself anymore either.
Oh, it doesn't matter whether she's on or not. Like, that doesn't matter. Like, she's so famous.
Like, if they want any corporate backing, if they had to do something, otherwise, I think their website probably would have been dead. But the this is just such a dark thing and a dark growing side. Because already, some people might be listening to this and thinking, do you know, is this really that serious? Like, these aren't real images.
So serious.
These are basically cartoons. But no, these are photorealistic as it is.
Mm.
And that technology is only going to improve. This is, as you say, Zara, effectively image-based sexual abuse.
Mm.
And it's only going to get worse unless you sort to, you know, actually have a complete zero tolerance policy on this. Mm-hmm. I know from a policy and a political standpoint on this, like the US House of Representatives is introducing a bill based on this, whereby if somebody has found that their image has been used to create deep fake porn in this way, that they would be the avenue would be open to them to sue the mm-hmm. person who either created it or intended to spread it. But I find that's going to be something which is going to get tied up in so much legal.
Given that a lot of the images are kind of generative and you don't necessarily know what the source of it is, like you can't
exactly,
even tell
yeah.
which app has created a fabricated thing, then who exactly were you prosecuting in those cases? So I don't see that being a good, robust...
But I mean, even listening to the story of that girl who found out that she had been, you know, the victim of AI-based sexual image violence in a job interview. Like, that is insane that she didn't even know about it until she was sitting in a job interview and they were like, look, we just wanted to know, you know, could you explain maybe this was this work that you chose to do in the past? Like, no judgment, but we just want to kind of know, was this kind of... But even the fact that that was presented to her in a job interview is insane.
It's bad online etiquette, but it's also just bad interpersonal etiquette.
But who does that?
Explain these nudes, please.
Well, also it's to suggest that, you know, women who do have agency and want to do that kind of work, you know, aren't entitled to get an office job then 3 or 4 years later, you know, that you're handed this folder and sort of asked, well, what kind of work were you doing before? It's actually nothing to do with your application for a receptionist or whatever it is, you know what I mean? But anyway, it's just the fact that she found out in that setting I thought was quite shocking.
That was just as a side note to all of that, as something of a coda, it was a very blunt but effective way to block the images was by blocking searches of her name.
Yeah.
I did see that a lot of Swifties were very put out that you couldn't search for any Taylor Swift content, good, bad or indifferent, as a result. And it's funny how she now continually becomes a lightning rod for this kind of stuff, because she's now also in the middle of the culture wars in the US for totally different reasons.
Yeah, just a quick note, just in terms of statistics on the deepfake content, 96%, according to a 2019 study, of online deepfake content has been pornographic in nature, which is a huge, huge number when you think about all the other AI-generated imagery which you have out there. 96%.
We're all petrified about elections being completely manipulated by a faked video of a leader saying something they didn't say, but actually...
It's mostly been used for, you know, faked up pornography. But as you say, the reason she was targeted in this way, and a lot of the accounts who spread this, are because Taylor Swift is now, again, a lightning rod in the culture war. She is, of course, now famously seeing Travis Kelce of the Kansas City Chiefs, who have made it to the Super Bowl. They'll be playing the San Francisco 49ers. But there has been a conspiracy theory which has grown legs online amongst right-wingers and Trump supporters online, that the Super Bowl is rigged. And that this is all a big conspiracy by the Biden administration and the Pentagon.
God, it's always the Pentagon.
It's always the Pentagon. Yeah. This is a Pentagon op, apparently.
Because it's a defense issue.
Yeah, but just to explain it. So basically, the thing is, Taylor Swift endorsed Joe Biden in 2020. And as the most famous and influential woman in many ways in the world, her endorsement will matter. Mm. And the Biden team has not made any secret of it, that they want her endorsement again. Not clear whether or not she'll get it. Probably will at this point, given how many, you know, Trump people are just going for her neck at this point. But the conspiracy theory goes that this is all rigged. The NFL has rigged the Super Bowl so that the Kansas City Chiefs, which he's only tangentially related to, will win the Super Bowl just so that... and then Taylor will have a big announcement after the Super Bowl as she endorses Joe Biden.
She's not playing the halftime show, which is worth saying.
I was just going to ask you that. Usher is playing
the halftime show.
Is Usher doing
and the NFL is traditionally, you might know better than this, Richard, but I imagine it's traditionally, if it's got any political leanings, that as an institution, it kind of leans Republican because all the participants are millionaires and all the owners are billionaires and they generally like how they've accrued their wealth and they don't want to be taxed out of it. They generally don't support the Democrats anyway. By and large, one would imagine. Yeah. So how the NFL is now somehow part of a giant conspiracy to endorse Joe Biden.
Can I ask, sorry, because I feel like there'll be people listening to this who are in the same boat as me. Were the Kansas City Chiefs, like, were they, are they good? Like,
they're brilliant.
Last year's.
Okay, well then fine then. So they're not, they're good. Yeah. Like, okay.
They're amazing. They're a really good team. They have the best quarterback in the game.
It's an obvious question. I just wanted to know if they're actually good then. Okay, fair enough.
That's Mahomes.
Exactly. Patrick Mahomes, he's amazing. He's the new Tom Brady.
So it's not like they were junior bees who have now had a
this isn't the Little Rascals. I'm sorry, the Little Giants.
Okay, it's fine. I'm just wondering.
Some of the theories, it is, sorry, worth saying, by the way, that a lot of the MAGA types still have a problem with Taylor Swift because they were convinced before her endorsement of Joe Biden that she was actually a white nationalist. And they're still really upset that she basically turned out not to be, or that they feel in some way betrayed, and that she must have gone full circle and now she's a secret Democratic operative.
Okay. That's not also to mention that Travis Kelce, they hate him because he did an endorsement deal, or he appeared in an ad for Pfizer back in the day as well. So obviously,
he's
a vaccine conspiracy thing as well. Yeah. So these are the most hated couple in America, as well as being the most photographed and shown. So there's been a huge pushback against the NFL and all of the networks in America, because every time the Kansas City Chiefs play, without failure, and fair play to Taylor Swift for going to every single one of these games, there's already been, you know, people doing calculations as to how she's going to get from her Tokyo show to the Super Bowl, and apparently it's possible.
There's loads of time. Her Tokyo show will end at 3 a.m. on Saturday morning, and the Super Bowl is on the West Coast on a Sunday afternoon. There's plenty of time to get a kip on a private plane.
I will admit that I'm not following that relationship super close, but I do love being on the periphery and seeing all the like lovely photos of them. She does look very happy.
I think she looks great. I think they look really happy together,
and I love that for her.
I remember I said at the start of this, when this was all only kicking off, I thought this was legit.
I think it is legit. Very obviously legit vibes.
Yeah.
But one group of people who have actually endorsed the legitness of this, and this is actually interesting because it folds into the culture war element, is a lot of these NFL and American sports talk radio and online personalities, your Pat McAfee's, your Colin Cowherd's, your Dan Lebatard's, none of those names will matter to many people, but they have huge millions and millions and millions of followers and viewers online. And a lot of those followers and viewers online would be right-wingers. Pat McAfee from ESPN had all this vaccine conspiracy stuff
also
recently.
From Monday Night Raw, which you can see Sunday mornings on Virgin Media too.
There you go. But he and these other presenters are basically saying, what's the big deal? Why are all these MAGA right wingers giving out about shots of Taylor Swift in the crowd celebrating things, like when otherwise you're showing shots of the crowd anyway and people's families? This is a good thing. It's shining more of a spotlight on football. It's allowing parents, whether they be dads and daughters, have something in common now because Taylor Swift and football, or mothers and sons. This is a good thing, and this is very silly. This is very, very silly, but everything is silly in 2024 and everything is the goddamn culture war.
Everything is silly. That should basically just be our tagline for every episode going forward. Everything is silly.
Silly but scary.
Speaking of silly, actually, you know who are really beneficiaries of all of this? Nickelodeon.
Oh.
CBS are broadcasting the Super Bowl on Sunday week in the US. It rotates between the major NFL broadcasters. CBS are the major ones, but they also own Nickelodeon. Nickelodeon, when they show NFL games, have it superimposed so that there is slime in the end zone. So there would already be people who would not usually be NFL watchers who might watch the Super Bowl if Patrick Mahomes is throwing a touchdown pass and Travis Kelce is catching it in slime. But if you also get to see Taylor Swift in doing all of that as well, then Nickelodeon are quids in for all of this. They're delighted with all of this.
Yeah. I think it was on ESPN that did a Toy Story version of one of the games. Like, it was augmented reality. And they had, like, it was all Andy's room and it was Woody and Buzz and all. Okay. It was mental. But it's great stuff. So that's one use of technology in the NFL that is a positive thing and not earth-shatteringly horrendous. Now, if you've found when you're driving around, if you drive around, it's getting harder and harder to park your car, it's possibly because new cars in Ireland, according to the journal.ie, have grown by 2.4% in width in the space of 5 years. So they're basically gaining half a centimetre in width every single year. I don't think...
Why is that?
Just because people want bigger and bigger cars. They want a bit more space. The size of SUVs in general are ridiculously big in comparison to what people use them for.
Yeah.
And the space they take up. And the dangers they pose to pedestrians and cyclists and everybody around.
I'm very aware that what I'm about to say is middle class privilege, right? But
you drive one of those quite large SUVs.
Well, we do, but I sort of feel like we actually don't have any other option. Because when I had to get a bigger car... When I knew that we were about to have baby number two.
Yeah.
And genuinely didn't feel like the existing car, which was not a small car by any means. It was a standard like four-door family car. Genuinely didn't feel like you could put all the stuff that two kids would need in the boot. That we had a double buggy in the back and basically there wasn't space for it to lie down. And when you had it upright, there was no room in the boot really for anything else. So I sort of felt like we had to trade up to the next size of car. And actually that's when you start to realise that there's basically no space in car parks, that I spend, as you guys do too, a lot of my time parking my car in a multi-story in the city centre. And they were all built before cars were as wide as they are now. And you suddenly find yourself sidling in and then doing that thing where you're trying to make yourself two-dimensional on the way out so that you can sidle out.
It's like the Ryanair hunch
kind of thing where you just like can't get out of the car. Like it's a thing. But I genuinely don't know how with two kids you could actually fit all the stuff that you need.
Yeah, fair.
They used to do it though with smaller cars.
But I think there were lower safety standards and ISOFIX bases and all that kind of stuff back in the day.
Do you think the buggies are smaller as well? I think the buggies are really fancy these days. Like buggies all my friends bigger. Have really high-end buggies. Like I can't get over the buggies. Like they're Rolls Royce level of buggies going around the place now. Like do you remember in our day when we were kids they were like basically a bit of like material and I'm like belting it to strap in and it folded down into nothing.
If there's any childless people watching or listening, just spend half an hour in Bella Baby and then just wince at how expensive it is to just buy stuff like that for your kids.
Yeah, but also, I mean, Gav, you're talking about the necessity of having a bigger car if you have kids and families. A lot of people do have even bigger cars than the one you have. Like if you're talking about the Range Rovers and your X5 and X3 BMWs.
I'm coming for the Range Rovers.
but like you do, if you're driving around Dublin.
I don't drive Range Rover, by the way.
In a Range Rover and you're like, you don't have kids or whatever.
If you're not going out to Glen of Amal on Sunday,
I don't know
why you
inconvenience yourself by doing it. Like, you're spending a lot for the inconvenience of not being able to park your car comfortably.
I think that's probably more status symbol stuff as well, though, isn't it? Like, it's a different motive, like, around that.
Not at all.
I mean,
just gone full Eamon Ryan on us now.
I drive a Volkswagen Beetle. I love my little car. I've driven a Beetle for many years, and I love it because it's really small and you can park it in lots of places. And I often just abandon it in lots of places, as you all know. There's a yellow box outside this building which usually has my Beetle parked in it.
People now going to Google Earth and going to look at the street view to see if
it's the car park for the studio.
It's not a public one.
I would never do that in public, but I would absolutely leave it in the yellow box here, and I'm often in the all at email being sent out, can Zara King please move her car? but it's funny because, like, I've had to drive my fiance's car for the last few days because my car went in to get something done, which still hasn't been sorted, actually. But we won't get into it. But I find his car way hard. It's about the same size as yours. Like, it's a bigger car. Like, and I do find it really hard to park it. And it even has one of those little cameras on it for parking. And I find the cameras kind of disorientating and harder to park with.
Don't have one of those, but
the beeping is like, what are you beeping for? It's like, oh, because I'm getting incredibly close to that wall there. Okay.
I don't know. I think it is something which, like, as the car, and apparently we're a bit of an outlier in Europe in terms of overall size. We have bigger cars here than most countries in Europe. Yeah, if you went to, say, France or Italy or Germany in the major cities, people want really small cars because it is much easier just to park them in, particularly for on-street parking. If you have a smart car or a Mini or some other one of those, you know, I can't remember what they're called. You know, the little small Volkswagen ones and there's little tiny Renault ones as well.
Yeah. Up or something.
Yeah, all those sort of ones.
Up and stuff,
but people want those because, well, A, it's easier to park, and B, actually, they don't use their cars as much because they have better public transport, which is kind of the root of the issue. So anyway, that's it.
How do you find parking? Let us know.
Drop into our social
media. Don't tell us about parking.
I don't want to hear how anybody gets on with parking. No, I have no interest whatsoever. But anyway, that was the episode.
I suppose give us your feedback on whatever you liked or didn't like. Drop into our socials. We're all still here all the time. Tell us what news is funny and why everything is mad.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.